It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about technology and privacy this morning. The fact that you were in a particular place at a particular time is recorded by the software on your smartphone. Software companies like Google track this data, and they hand it over to the government from time to time. This was the case in Kenosha after last summer's protests. Federal authorities sought to identify anyone near the arson sites that occurred at the protest after Jacob Blake was shot. We know this because of warrants that were issued have now become unsealed. This has raised questions about privacy and rights in the digital age. Do you think this is justified? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org. With us this morning, we have Russell Brandom, policy editor at the tech news website, The Verge. Welcome, Russell.
Thanks for having me.
Good morning. We also have with us Jake LaPerruque, senior policy counsel for the Constitution Project on the Project on Government Oversight. That's a government watchdog group. Jake, good morning.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad you're both with us. Well, Jake, I want to start with you, and I want to understand what we're talking about here, the process that police and investigators can use to obtain location data from specific areas. Can you tell me how that works?
Yeah, so this is a certain type of location tracking technique. Most typically, police, if they have a suspect in an investigation, they'll get a warrant, go to a company and say, hey, you know, this is our suspect. Here's our probable cause. We want to track their phone for a while. What these geofence warrants do instead, though, is basically cast out a dragnet, where instead of going after a person, they go after an area. So they'll go to a company like Google and say, you know, we have reason, something related to a crime that we want to know about this area. Give us the cell phone data of everyone in it. And it can be really specific, like, you know, just basically the area around a single building, or it can be really broad, like multiple city blocks for hours and hours at a time, and basically scooping up, vacuuming up every single cell phone in it and cataloging everyone who was at that location.
And for what period of time? I mean, I looked at the warrants that were published and there's an address, but it doesn't say when.
Yeah, so it tends to be historic. So you're going back, you know, looking at an older date and time. But the range of time can either be really specific. Like one of those warrants was just for about, I think, you know, under 30 minutes, because that was when they knew a certain crime had happened. Okay. Some of them, however, are much broader. They'll ask for, you know, hours and hours at a time. You know, so basically just kind of getting a catalog of everyone who was in an area. And again, you know, that might just be who was in this building, but it might be who was even in, you know, a full downtown area when, say, something like a protest was going on.
Yeah. And Russell, you wrote about the use of this technique after Kenosha. And I wonder, what was the scope of the warrants that were issued in Kenosha?
I mean, I think we're really still finding out about it. You mentioned the seven locations. Since my article went up on, you know, last week, we've actually gotten six more for sort of a variety of car dealerships and the destruction of this garbage truck. So, you know, it's entirely plausible that there are more that haven't been unsealed that we just haven't found out about yet. I think otherwise, I mean, you see a huge variation. Some of them, they'll say, look, we have this footage of someone, you know, throwing flaming objects at this bank. We know it happened in this 20-minute span, so we just want anyone who is in the parking lot during that 20 minutes. And then another one, they say, well, we found this, you know, charred rags in a window well of the public library. So we want from 1 to 3 a.m. anyone who was in this block of public park, you know, at the center of the city. And you think, you know, that's a lot broader. That's going to pick up a lot of people. And I think part of what's so unnerving about these is the warrants really just look exactly the same. There's no additional consideration for a much broader request.
Well, and I guess one could raise the question, what's the big deal? So we heard from Mary in Milwaukee, in fact, and she says it's absolutely appropriate for police and government to track your GPS. You know, they need this kind of data in order to solve crimes. Jake, what do you think?
Well, I worry a lot about something like this because it potentially starts to loop in a lot of sensitive activity and activity that, you know, I think we can agree that if you're burning down a building and engaged in arson, yes, that's not acceptable activity. Police absolutely have the right to investigate and prosecute people for that. But you have a lot of people who are peaceful protesters or engaged in other types of sensitive activities that this could vacuum up en masse. And I think it's important to think about something like this in the context of kind of collecting sensitive activities in the past. If you go back to the era of J. Edgar Hoover and COINTELPRO, there were efforts to catalog individuals using FBI plans at protests, at rallies, at demonstrations, at anti-war and civil rights events, and kind of figure out these people who were government dissidents. You can go all the way back to just about 20 years ago after 9/11, the NYPD had a massive surveillance operation targeted at Muslims where they would send in what they literally called mosque crawlers to go to Muslim community centers, mosques, catalog everyone in mosques, catalog everyone in Muslim community centers. When we talk about a geofence warrant, it's potentially taking those sort of law unwinding undercover operations to catalog people, and you can do that off the push of a button. So the potential for abuse is really huge.
Well, Jake, what data do they actually receive? I mean, you would know that a phone is in a particular location at a particular time, but it doesn't tell you who's holding it, right?
Yeah, the technical information is about the phone. So there might be some level of protection there, but typically it's pretty easy to tie a phone's identifying information to a person.
So they're making the assumption then, and that's legally valid?
Yeah. And
it's your phone. We could assume it was you that was there?
Yeah, and I think especially, you know, when we talk about not necessarily how is this going to be used in investigation, where that might be a first step and you confirm it in other ways and build a case. And, you know, again, I think, you know, kind of that type of use the goal, I should say, might be more acceptable. If we're talking about the abuse scenarios, how it might be used to, say, catalog peaceful protesters, catalog dissidents, catalog people at a religious ceremony or political rally, then you get not only to the risk that you're actually going to count people, but just the mere risk is going to chill people out of those activities. And that's something else that we see a lot for surveillance of protesters is if you're flying a drone over protests, if you're recording video of protesters and running it with face recognition, using these advanced type of surveillance tools that geofence warrants fall in the range of, sometimes just the mere risk of that, whether it ends up playing out or not, is going to scare people out of exercising their First Amendment rights.
Yes. Russell, I want to know from you, do people have an understanding? I mean, is there that this is occurring? Is there any way you would know on your phone that you're giving this data up at any moment?
You can. I mean, there's no way to know if the police have requested it from Google. And that's by design, because again, they're trying to, you know, often they're using this to surveil criminals. They don't want, you know, the drug dealers to know that they're wiretapping a phone, et cetera. And so, you know, that's why these warrants have been sealed for a year. So you would have gone to a protest and then a year later, you know, here's some folks writing a news article about it. It's very deliberately kept secret. I will say, if you're concerned about Google having this information from you, one thing you can do is if you go to Google Maps, there's a little, you see sort of a three line icon in the upper left, and you can check for my data in Maps, and it'll say if Google is collecting location history. And you can turn it off. I think a lot of people have it on without realizing it. It's more complicated to be if you have an Android phone because it's integrated into Android, but that is something people can do.
And is Google Maps mainly what we're talking about here, or are there other software applications that are doing the same thing?
It's primarily Google Maps because Google is the only company with this broad of a scope. In particular, it's it's not just that it's checking the GPS. It's when Google Maps places that blue dot, they're using a huge range of information from your device, including like the Wi-Fi network you're connected to, and a lot of other signals are going into that. And so on Android phones, Google has access to sort of the whole stack. And Apple has generally not retained that information in a way that's accessible to warrant requests, in part because they don't need it for targeted advertising. Google would sort of like it for targeted advertising. So right. It tends to be Google is where the warrants are going.
Right. Our guest this morning, Russell Brandom, policy editor with the website The Verge, and Jake LaPerouque, senior policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight. You're listening to The Morning Show, and I'm Molly Stenz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenz. What effect do you think digital surveillance has on free speech? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Email us, ideas@wpr.org. Our guests this morning, Russell Brandom, policy editor at The Verge, and Jake LaPerouque, senior policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight. Well, Jake, we were talking about why this matters. Who cares? And I want to drill into that a little bit more. Say I was at a protest as a journalist. I was there in Kenosha watching something happen. Or maybe I'm a citizen recording it with, you know, filming things with my camera. So I'm standing there at a sensitive site. I have my cell phone on me. And I have Google Maps installed, and so it's cataloging that data, and I'm going to show up in this database of people that were on the scene of a potential crime. How does that matter to me? Does that implicate me in any way? They know my phone was there, and so what? Like, does that what does that do to me?
Well, it may or may not matter for you on an individual basis, but I think it certainly does create risks for some people who are involved in, you know, these kind of expressive activities, especially when you're criticizing the government. And typically the people who are most vulnerable to harm tend to be the people who are most vulnerable to abuse in the criminal justice system and for government in general. And this is something we've seen a lot from Black Lives Matter activists over the past 6 years. There have been some very pervasive efforts using different surveillance technologies to track Black Lives Matter activists, to track, hey, who shows up at protests in different cities, who's active, and that can lead to a whole array of abuse. It can lead to selective targeting. It can lead to mistreatment. We've seen numerous cases of that. I think, you know, it's important to think about these things. I mean, I'm sure on an individual level, people can look at us, can, you know, kind of go to that mantra of, I have nothing to hide. I personally have nothing to worry about. It's important to think of privacy as not just a individual freedom issue, but as a civil rights issue, and think about, well, you know, is the right to be shielded from pervasive surveillance something that's not so much important to me as an individual basis, but how does it protect people who might be marginalized, victimized, or targeted in society in unfair ways?
Well, and Russell, I want to talk about Google's role in this. This process, they are served a warrant by the government. What do they have options? I mean, do they have to turn over the data? What's their latitude in fulfilling these requests?
I mean, I think they can't just tell the government to sort of take a hike. They have to sort of give up some version of the data that the government is asking for. I mean, it's a court order. They're legally compelled. I think we see in the warrants that they do a little bit of a dance around it. There is this sort of process that they seem to have come up with where they say, well, okay, we'll give you the data points, but we aren't going to tell you who anyone is or anything identifiable. And then you'll say, of those data points, which ones you want us to identify. But I mean, there's nothing stopping the government from just saying we should identify all of them. I do think the big choice that Google has is whether they want to build this system in a way that they're retaining the data at all. And that's sort of what we see between them and Apple is, you know, they fundamentally have left this channel open where they have really detailed location data on some of their users, and police are going to ask for it.
Well, yeah, that's my question, because I think back to the Patriot Act and I think back to decisions that the Library Association made where they decided, you know, like, we're not going to keep records of the books that people check out intentionally. We're not going to build this database. Like, we're going to use it in the moment for when we have the need to track, you know, when it's due and what your fines are and that kind of thing. But they decided we're not going to keep this data because we don't want to build this trail, this digital trail. Could Google make that choice?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would also say, like, think about the, not to get too big picture, but you think about the technological changes that have happened in the last 20 or 30 years. You know, there's no warrant in the world that will get you, you know, a recording of every phone call someone has had in the last, you know, year, right? Because those recordings just don't exist. The phone company doesn't collect that data. But if you want their email, yeah, it's easy to find every email a person's ever sent from that account. And so there is just this huge amount of data being collected right now. And that results in this kind of warrant where suddenly there's a lot more information on where you've been than you might be comfortable with.
You know, and the other thing that I think about in the wake of the NSA revelations that were brought to us about government having access, kind of backdoor access to companies that were revealed to us by Edward Snowden. Is that a risk here that even though there is a warrant process, there is a legal process by which data can be obtained, that, you know, as we've seen in the past, sometimes government agencies create other routes for access of data?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think not just government agencies. I mean, I think the idea of, you know, Google has some internal sort of provisions to make sure there isn't just some, you know, creepy ex who works at Google looking at all this stuff. But like, I do think when you look at something like this, like the warrants that I reported on, you have to keep in mind, this is when they're doing it by the book. This is, they went to court, they got this court order, they got the data sort of the legal, clean way. Are there instances where someone doesn't go through the front door and it doesn't leave a paper trail and we just don't know about it? Like, there's no way to know. There's no way that we would find out.
Until perhaps there's a whistleblower years in advance and then we learn.
It's true. Yeah, this is, I mean, again, this is just the risk of having this data out there in the world.
So you mentioned they keep this data for advertising purposes. How would that work, or how would that be
well
useful?
So I mean, I think, imagine, you know, you're starting a burrito restaurant and you want to target an ad at people who have been to burrito restaurants in the last year. You know, Google has, because they have this information, they can target at, you know, these are the users who have been to a burrito restaurant. They might be interested in your burrito restaurant as well. And I mean, this is fundamentally what makes Google one of the largest and most profitable companies in the world, is that targeted advertising system. This wasn't something anyone had any idea how to do before. And now it's a really valuable advertising technique, but it's built on this massive data collection. And I think location data is one of the more valuable forms of data that Google targets against. But so that's the useful side. That's the good side. There's also some drawbacks for users.
So there's no financial incentive, essentially, for them to dump this data. Like, this is their business model.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, I was talking before, I was saying you can turn on the location tracking or turn it off. If you turn it off, that makes you less valuable to Google as a user, because they make money by collecting this data and targeting ads against it. And that's data that they don't have now.
We are speaking about the the technique called geofencing and data privacy on the morning show. Our guests this morning are Russell Brandom. He's a policy editor at The Verge. That's a tech website. And we're also speaking with Jake LaPerouque. He's a senior policy counsel on the Project on Government Oversight. Do you think digital surveillance has an effect on freedom of speech? Is it a chilling effect? We're at 1-800-642-1234 or ideas@WPR.org. I'm Molly Stentz, and this is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're talking about the practice of geofence warrants. Do you care if your location data is shared with law enforcement or other organizations without your consent? We're at 1-800-642-1234. ideas@WPR.org. We're speaking with Russell Brandom, policy editor at the tech news website The Verge. We also have Jake LaPerouque, senior policy counsel for the Constitution Project from the Project on Government Oversight. It's a government watchdog group. Well, I want to go to the phones because we have a caller willing to weigh in on this question we've been posing. We're going to go to Milwaukee where we have Mike with us. Good morning, Mike.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yep. I just wanted to respond to your question and my reaction to it. Is this having a chilling effect on speech and the collection of the data itself? And I'd say that the problem is that it does. It's just that it doesn't appear that it does. And the reason for that is for the same reason that all this data exists because of electronic communication. It appears like we have more communication right now than we've ever had. There's just people communicating about everything. But the problem with that is that most of that communication is really banal and entertainment based, and that real actual political discourse, like how do you resolve real political problems, people who see the world one way versus the other way, that isn't happening because people who actually would have an opinion about that are kind of afraid of putting their information out electronically because they know it's going to be recorded. They know pretty much their entire lives are going to be recorded. Thank you.
Okay, Mike. So you're saying it is having a chilling effect, but people are self-censoring, and so therefore the data that's being collected is maybe just tons and tons of cat videos or memes or, you know, things that people are sharing. So maybe the value of the data that the government's collecting isn't all that high. Jake, what do you think about that?
Yeah, and I should mention, I think that there are studies to confirm this chilling effect notion. It is not purely theoretical. For example, you know, after the Snowden revelations and it came out, there was a lot more online collection than most people assumed. There were notable trends in decrease in use of online trackable services like online banking, online communications. These actually went down in tangible ways because people suddenly saw that their activities were being tracked more. Another one I mentioned before, the Muslim surveillance unit that NYPD operated after 9/11, some studies after the fact of, you know, that surveillance and how it impacted Muslim communities showed that there were actual very significant decreases in association and community engagement because those communities saw that they were being surveilled, being monitored on a scale that, you know, was unprecedented, and it actually did concretely have this chilling effect on those communities.
And I wonder too about the use of flip phones, right? Because one thing that has been interesting to me when I kind of look at data is that we still sell a lot of flip phones in this country, old school non-smartphones. Are those implicated in any of these discussions? I mean, they don't have apps. They don't have Google Maps on them.
Yeah, I'm not sure Russell might have an idea of kind of the vulnerability to a geofence warrant. I mean, like you said, it does bring in a lot of different techniques, some of which are connected to smartphones. So I think that might be harder. I mean, there certainly are, though, plenty of tools that the government does use for tracking even more kind of, you know, old school phones like that.
Russell, what do you think about the flip phones?
Yeah, well, so I think one thing that you do see is sort of cell tower warrants. So, you know, your flip phone, even if you're just using it to call someone, it has to connect to the cell tower, and there's data on which cell tower it connected to. And so then they can, you know, if you're a prosecutor, you can say, well, okay, we know he was generally in the area of the cell tower. But, you know, you think about that compared to the specific blue dot on the Google Maps. It's a much bigger area. It's much broader. It's much harder to stand in front of a judge and say, well, we know that puts him at the scene of the crime. So, you know, it's sort of a step in the right direction, but there is still some information.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I wonder, too, about stingrays, where this process of basically emulating a cell tower.
Yeah. I mean, that tends to be... You know, this is, you're referring to the fake cell tower where, you think of the FBI surveillance van and they're looking around and they say, okay, we want to know where this particular phone is. And they're looking at it almost like a homing device and they can find, okay, we know it's in this apartment. You know, those tend to be still pretty specific. It's been a struggle finding out which government agencies have them, which are using them, how they're using them. But the good news is that is usually when they are looking for a specific sort of phone number or specific subject. Obviously, it's more concerning if they're saying, okay, let's collect all the phone numbers that are in this crowd because we have some stingray there.
There's
a range of techniques.
You're saying these are more targeted. The stingrays?
In most uses. It's tricky, though. You always worry what we don't know about.
Sure. So I wonder what policy implications this has, and what can be done or what is being talked about. Jake, there's some legislation to address the process of geofencing warrants, as I understand.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of potential legislative bills in Congress about location tracking right now. And this kind of goes back to a few years ago, the Supreme Court issued a general ruling saying cell phone tracking, it's so pervasive now, it's so invasive in how it monitors people, you need a warrant to do that. This is basically equivalent of a search. So that sort of set up a new standard, but it also, because it was a court ruling, you know, tended to be much more broad and set on the principle rather than the specifics, and that's left a lot of loopholes. And there are a few different bills in Congress now to potentially fill some of those loopholes and add some specificity. One is focused on a loophole around buying data. And this is a practice where basically a lot of government agencies, after it was said that, well, if you want to track someone's phone, you need a warrant. They said, well, why don't we just go to a data broker and buy it instead of going to get a warrant? This is kind of the equivalent of, you know, instead of getting a warrant to search your apartment, if the police just went to the landlord and said, here's $100, can I look in the apartment? And the landlord gave them a key. So that's obviously a loophole that needs to be filled. There's a bill called the Fourth Amendment's Not for Sale Act that would fix that problem. Then there's stingrays that Russell mentioned that kind of typically they do get a warrant for stingrays, but because they have cover this big area in the same way as geofence warrants, there needs to be more specification for that. Limits on when you can do them, limits on how big the range can be, limits on what do you do with that kind of extra data that you get on non-suspects. There's a bill called the Cell Site Simulator Warrant Act that would deal with that. Unfortunately for geofences, they're kind of the last piece of the puzzle that's missing. There's currently no legislation in Congress that would deal with geofence warrants and the fact that, you know, even if you do get a warrant for them, you're still potentially scooping up data on hundreds, thousands, you know, if it's a really big crowd, maybe even tens of thousands of people that are not suspected of a crime. So hopefully, you know, as all these other location tracking issues are getting more attention in Congress, this is one that will join the pack as far as potentially having some stricter rules set around it.
I mean, do you think it's necessary, given that individuals can take their own actions? I mean, consumers can make choices to turn off those location settings on their phones.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I mean, there's always going to be potential ways around this. Like Russell said, you know, Google's probably the primarily company, but not necessarily the only ones. And I think just a general notion of whether it's through this specific data that Google's grabbing or other, it makes a lot of sense that if law enforcement ever is going to ask for location area for an entire area, that there are pretty strict rules around it. There's the kind of the focus of the cell site, the Stingray bill, is basically establishing a super warrant, is what we call it, where you have to show that you either tried or couldn't even try less invasive means because they just simply wouldn't work. Where you, if you have any extra data about people who are connected to the crime, if you have what I call collateral damage to privacy, where you're scooping up private information about non-suspects, that you're deleting that immediately. That's the type of thing that I think should be built around geofence warrants. The onus shouldn't be on an individual to stop the government from monitoring their every move. There should be basic rules to prevent abuse of it.
And Russell, in the case of Kenosha that we were talking about earlier this hour, do we have any sense of what that data is being used for? And how much do we know?
Well, so one thing that the warrants make clear is that this is sort of, they're all filled by this special squad of ATF investigators that sort of came into town in response to the unrest. And so they are looking sort of, they are trying to prosecute arson cases. And that's a consistent theme, like that, you know, each of the warrants sort of starts with some, you know, building that suffered some sort of property damage or there were indications of attempted arson, and they're looking for people who were in that area. I do think there's this question of how much is this a good faith effort to find the arsonist and how much is it a sort of effort to find people who were in the crowd? Because I, you know, looking at a lot of these warrants, it does not seem like a good way to find the people who actually committed these crimes. You're going to get these hundreds of names and potentially, you know, there are lots of people who would have been in the area, but because they didn't have an Android phone or they had turned off their location tracking, they just wouldn't be in the warrant request. So I think that part is sort of the concerning part. And again, like the nature of, you know, a sealed warrant is that we don't know the full scope of this investigative effort. All we know is what's been unsealed.
And what do we know about data sharing agreements? I mean, these were requested by the ATF. Who else would have access to the data?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, there are fundamentally, you know, that goes to the office that is prosecuting those crimes. I think if they have related things that they're looking into, is that also potentially accessible to them? I think, you know, it's a major effort from those prosecutors to sort of prosecute crimes that are related to this generally. So if there's also some looting incident, you know, are they going to use this as probable cause for that? There are legal restrictions on it, but I think, you know, it's absolutely valid to be concerned.
We're speaking with Russell Brandom, policy editor at The Verge. Also with us, Jake LaPerouc, senior policy counsel for the Constitution Project from the Project on Government Oversight. I'm Molly Stentz. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz. We're speaking this morning with Jake LaPerouc, senior policy counsel for the Constitution Project from the Project on Government Oversight. It's a government watchdog group. We also have with us Russell Brandom, policy editor at the tech news website The Verge. We're talking about technology and your privacy. Do you care? if location data is shared with law enforcement or other organizations without your consent, weigh in here. We're at 1-800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. And we have a call coming in from Menominee Falls this morning. We're going to go to the phones and talk to Lisa. Lisa, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Thank you so much for holding a show on this topic. I am very concerned about privacy in the United States. My question is not, I don't know if you've covered this. I came into the show a little bit late, but number one, is there any legislation anywhere with a chance of advancing that includes the right to be forgotten like it is in Europe? And then secondly, are there any legislators in Wisconsin who seem to be more focused on privacy? I care very much about this issue, and those are the people I want to vote for in the next election. Thank you. And also, thank you for The Verge. It's an excellent publication. Thank you.
Thank you, Lisa. Well, Jake, I'm going to toss that to you about the right to be forgotten.
Yeah, the right to be forgotten is a very interesting concept. It you know, kind of goes a little less towards government monitoring and more just people's ability to kind of keep their own data private off the internet, which, you know, I think definitely for just, you know, your average Joe who doesn't want their home address, you know, like something that happened to them when they were a child on the internet, you know, raises a lot of reasonable concerns there, but also then gets into some First Amendment issues about, you know, what if I want to talk about a public figure and they just, you know, want to be forgotten, want to have something negative about that they said or did stripped off. So yeah, I'm not sure about legislation on that front because it does run into some free speech issues. It is interesting to see entities like Google that are, you know, potentially, I think, trying to do more now for kind of keeping the ability to have information about public figures, about, you know, important things up, but also trying to give flexibility. If someone says, hey, I want to have something like, you know, potentially sensitive or dangerous information purged from Google search results, about how you can get that done. On the legislative front, I mentioned the Fourth Amendment's Not for Sale Act before. This is kind of the main vehicle for beefing up the location privacy rules on a nationwide level. I know Tim Baldwin is a co-sponsor of that legislation. It has 20 senators signed on to it now, which is a pretty good number. You know, and also in a pretty partisan Congress, it's got Democrats and Republicans on it. So this is one of those few things that does seem to cross the aisle.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for that call, Lisa. Well, I want to ask about COVID tracking, because I feel like the past year we've seen the rise of a lot of new apps, particularly for contact tracing. And I wonder about the data privacy implications of these. Would these, Jake, be subjected to a similar kind of geofencing warrant potentially?
So the way the main COVID tracking apps designed by Google and Apple work is to try to minimize that by basically anonymizing data, looking at data for kind of how your sort of tag matches up with other people who might have gotten COVID, and then only triggering it when that happens. Now that can raise some geofence issues in terms of how the data is retained and issues like that. We haven't seen those too much, and I think, you know, this is something that privacy advocates spent a good amount of time on early in COVID thinking about. We have seen in some other countries where there was more vigorous contact tracing that it actually has been repurposed for law enforcement and kind of then, you know, taken out of this public health bucket and put into a policing bucket. So far, we haven't, I don't think, seen that here. There seem to have been fairly good efforts to kind of limit the scale that data is kept and retained to try to kind of put it more only in that public health bucket. You know, I think that's a reasonable concern, but probably not a huge level of risk.
Right. Because while this data could be helpful for contact tracing, for public health uses, for public health, I mean, I could imagine public health administrators loving to have a data set that they could use to inform people about risks or exposures. They don't have the ability to seek these warrants. This is only law enforcement.
Yeah. Pretty much all contact tracing apps have been voluntary.
Yes.
In terms of their implementation.
Yes. Well, Russell, I wonder what you were up against the end of our hour here, but I want to hear what you're working on and what you're following right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think on this story in particular, we're just seeing more warrants roll in. And I do think it makes me wonder both sort of what else, you know, folks were looking at in the wake of the Kenosha unrest. And also, you know, we've seen other protests that were targeted by this in the sort of part of the broader Black Lives Matter movement, which, you know, a lot of the time there would be some incidents of property damage associated with the protests, even though most of the people there were sort of doing lawful, peaceful protests. And so, yeah, I mean, we're only seeing these now because they got unsealed. I think the question is, what else is sealed? Where else was this happening? You know, where else is this technique being used?
How much information can you get from Google's transparency reports that would kind of hint at the broader scope of the requests that they might be receiving?
Yeah, I mean, so we do not know specifically, you know, they'll report the overall number, but actually they just started reporting geofence warrants specifically. We don't know the details of each one, but we know the overall number, which in last year they got 11,500, a little more than 11,554 geofence warrants, which is just a huge number. And again, you know, these were seen because they're coming through the federal courts. A lot of them are coming, you know, the vast majority are coming through local courts. So, you know, looking at that, that's 1,000 a month, basically. This is really a widely used technique. And I think we still don't fully know how it's being used.
Right. So what will you look for next?
Oh, I mean, whatever I can find. I think the question of, you know, in that report, they said 95% of it was coming from local courts. And so I think the question is how is it being used locally, maybe even in even smaller instance, and sort of for less specific crimes. I don't know. I mean, I think that's right now all eyes are turning towards the local courts.
Sure. We're speaking this morning with Russell Brandom, policy editor at The Verge, and Jake LaPerouque, senior policy counsel at the Project on Government Oversight. Well, we have just a minute left, less than that, really. But final thoughts, Jake, about what you're watching next on this horizon?
Yeah, well, I think one thing I'm very curious about is kind of breaking open the scale of this is, I mean, geofence is one issue, but what other surveillance tools are being used in this way and how much? For example, my colleague Jason Palladino last year discovered a custom and border protection aerial surveillance plane flying over Minneapolis monitoring protests, you know, hundreds of miles south of the border. Why was Customs and Border Protection there? A few months ago, there was a report that revealed that Florida police in a few cities were.
And unfortunately, I hate to cut you off, Jake, but we are right up against the clock. I'm so sorry there. But great conversation this hour. Thank you so much. Jake LaPerouque, senior policy counsel for the Constitution Project from the Project on Government Oversight. Also with us, Russell Brandom, policy editor at The Verge. Thank you.